This is Jason Stacy interviewing Greg Kessler for Madison Historical. The date is November 3rd, 2021 at 4:12 in the afternoon. We're at Recess Brewery and we're talking about the music scene in the 1980s here in Madison County. Greg, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm from Granite City. I was born in 1967, went all through Granite City Public School. I really didn't discover music in any serious way until high school. My first concert was Bob Seger, and Michael Bolton opened up in 1983 at the arena. It was astonishing. But I didn't go to a lot of concerts. I didn't go to a lot of... I think the next concert I went to was Van Halen 1984, which we only bought tickets to because Slade was supposed to open up, and they didn't. Velcro opened up, which was a Romantics ripoff band. And then I don't think I went to another... I didn't really go to a lot of arena concerts. Not long after that, I discovered other music and went to... So high school, I didn't see a lot. The first live band I can remember seeing was freshman year in high school at our first dance. A band called Beowulf played. I'm sure it's inaccurate, but I have this image of them wearing like leather vests with no shirts and trying to look, you know, super Frank Frazetta in front of a bunch of high school kids. And again, I'm sure they didn't, but I have this image that they likely played, you know, The Tower by Angel and maybe some Trooper and, you know, some Billy Squire or something.
Now, Greg, usually when I think of the greater St. Louis area, I think of this as a classic rock area. And you're proving that true in what you're describing. I think of K-She as defining the region. But I know you've done some research on the punk rock scene in the greater St. Louis area. And I know you played in a band called Snake Ranch. So I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit what punk rock was like, what the scene was like here in the Midwest when you were younger.
Okay, well, to begin with, anything I know about it is things I've learned about it in hindsight, because there were things going on when I was in high school, but I had no concept of it. So on the east side, there were bands, well, there weren't a lot. There was a band, Club Zero from Alton was around in 83, I think. I graduated in 85. So they were around in 83. Max Lode, which is actually Belleville, but played around. They were around in 81, I think. There was a band called East Vietnam that was around in that time period that I only know the name. There were some shows, I think, in Edwardsville, but it didn't exist to any great degree. Around 80, I'm not even sure, I'm going to get yelled at for it. There were other bands that came out after that. There were bands like the Bishops and the Mockers that showed up around the same time. But again, I wasn't aware of any of this. My introduction to everything was in St. Louis, going to Animal House and seeing the Nukes for the first time, and the Eyes, and bands like Boyfriend and Ferrari that were doing Night Ranger songs and stuff. But the Nukes were definitely an early St. Louis punk band. Oddly enough, the Nukes took that name and didn't realize that there was another band called the Nukes that preceded them by about 5 or 6 years that they had no concept of. So all that stuff I had no concept of any of that stuff. And I knew there were shows at Mississippi Nights, and I knew there were things going on in Granite. The only thing that I know happened in Granite City was my senior year in 84 85, a band called Rude Pets who had actually opened for the Dead Kennedys and opened for TSOL, who were more of like a new wave cover band, played an under 21 place called Nash's in Granite with another band called State of Shock, which was a new wave band from St. Louis. They played, but I wasn't near cool enough to have gone. Friends of mine went to see it, and thought it was really cool. And then those same people, Rude Pets actually opened for The Clash at Kiel when they came through on Combat Rock after most of the band had quit. But the Rude Pets did that. So they already knew the Rude Pets, and they went to that. But I wasn't near cool enough to go. I was still way wearing bell bottoms at that point, and I think playing Dungeons & Dragons more than I should have. But they played that stuff. So that was something that was happening in Missouri, or in Illinois at the time, but I had no concept of it.
Yeah. So would you say St. Louis was primarily where most of the kids went for shows?
Sure. There wasn't very much going on here. In Madison County, the big thing, there were bars where people played, but it was mostly cover bands. In fact, when I worked at IHOP Midnights at one point, we used to have these regulars come in and talk, and I said something about wanting to be in a band, and the guy looked at me and he said, well, there's only two things people in Granite City make, babies and bands. Neither of them turn out any good. So there was, yeah, I mean, everybody went to St. Louis for that stuff. Now, like I said, Club Zero was playing, so they were playing VFW shows and things like that on the east side of the river, and they were doing battles of the bands on the east side of the river, but I had no concept of it.
Yeah.
The first time I came into contact with an east side band was Judge Nothing. It was Club Zero at the time. They played at SIU in the Meridian Ballroom with Ultraman from St. Louis and Naked Raygun.
Wow.
And there were a few shows, and that was February of 86. And there were a few shows right before that were put on by like a left-wing group at the school. But that night, people from St. Louis came over and absolutely destroyed the University Center. Broke the elevator, smashed all the trophy cases, broke the ice cream machine. I mean, they just slaughtered. But I saw Club Zero, saw Ultraman. I already knew who Naked Raygun was. But I didn't know who either of those bands were. And I saw them, and I didn't even talk to them, but saw them interact with people and had no idea who they were. Within a year, we were playing with them. But it was, and I had no clue what was going on.
And you were playing with them with Snake Ranch?
Yeah, we played our very first show at Corner Tavern, which was in Edwardsville right behind the Farm Fresh.
Yep.
And they had started having shows there I think a little bit earlier than that. We played our first show March 7th of 87, and it wasn't Snake Ranch, it was the Beer Frogs, which is basically the same guys, but we played, I think we practiced for 2 weeks, wrote like 12 songs, learned a couple of covers, and played. It was absolute chaos.
And what were you guys called again? The Beer Frogs?
Yeah.
And who was your inspiration? This would have been 86?
No, it was March 7th of 87.
Okay, and so
March 6th, one of the two.
Who were you trying to sound like with those 12 songs?
Oh, I have no idea.
Okay.
We wrote, Jim Bone was playing guitar, so a lot of it was up to Jim and whatever he wrote. And we actually had two guitar players. The other guy was a guy named Mike Slinsky. And I actually have on a tape somewhere, because a lot of our songs were just the same riff over and over again. And I have a recording of Mike, who was a decent guitar player at the time, screaming, "Just one change! Come on, damn it, just one change!" So it has been a mantra for the last 30 years, because a lot of them were just and with no change in it, no idea. So we had no clue. We were just gonna go. And even the idea of being in a band, I had never considered being in a band ever. But we would go to Animal House, and I don't know if it was late 85 or early 86, I was going to McKendree in Lebanon, but they had come to pick me up and take me to Animal House one night, and I was messing around.
And where was Animal House?
Animal House was at 367 in Bell Fountain. It was the old Mark Twain Theater. I saw Jaws there.
Okay.
And then they had pulled a bunch of the seats out, put couches in, had a band, and then the upstairs was actually, on Friday nights, was like a hip-hop club.
Uh-huh.
And then Saturday night, the whole place was a hip-hop club.
Uh-huh.
But on Fridays, it was more of a new wave club downstairs. And I was playing around, and I was acting dumb. And it seems like, in my head, I remember somebody being very sad. There was always somebody crying. That's what we did. Not why I did, but, you know, everybody was depressed. And so I was messing around trying to make somebody laugh. And Jim Harper, was my friend, and one of the guys came to get me and said, you know, I'm going to start a band and you're going to be the singer. And I went home, I went back to McKendree, and because when Jim says something, I go, okay. And so for the next month, I wrote lyrics. And then when I saw him again, I don't know if he was surprised or not, I said, are we going to practice? And so Jim and I kept trying to get things together, and we just it just didn't work out. We weren't really looking for, we weren't doing it the right way. But he met Jim Bone and Mike Selinsky at a fraternity in at SIU, and said, okay, we're going to do this. So it was Mike and Jim and Keith Grillion, who was from Granite, a guy named Mark Sova, and like I said, we played, and we only played, I think we played three shows. I think we played twice at Corner and once in the basement of the like community center at SIU at the what are the dorms called?
Cougar Village?
No, 30 years ago, before they built that stuff, it was like the family units. Like the apartments and stuff.
Yeah, that's not Cougar Village, huh?
No, it's by the lake.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
So we played there. I don't know why we played that.
So who's your audience? Who showed up? I mean, do you have friends show up? Or
our very first show we played with... we played with Club Zero. Uh-huh. So they had a crowd. But then we told people. We said, hey, we're going to play. We're going to do this. So people did show up and watched us just massacre the stage. And... I want to say Jim went through the wall at one point. It was just chaos. It was just absolute chaos. There was no music to what we were doing.
Yeah.
But someone remarked that it looked like Black Flag opening for REM. Because Club Zero, and they just had a reunion the other day. They're fabulous musicians. Man, they can write. They should have been stars. We were just bedlam on stage. Our friends showed up, and then we immediately started meeting other bands.
Mm-hmm.
So this one at SIU, not a lot of people showed up, but I actually have it on tape, mm-hmm. which is awful. And it's the first time my parents came, so they were like, well, this is a waste of your life. but then the next one, the second one we played, lots of people showed up.
And you're still beer frogs at this time?
Yeah. And lots of people showed up, and one of the guys showed up was the guys from Whoppers Taste Good, who were a hardcore band from St. Louis, and they're the ones that recorded our first demo, and I mean, it just sort of spidered out from there, and I think that's, to me at least, and I could be completely wrong, it seems like 86, 87 is when things start happening more on this side of the river. Band called the Primitives, who eventually become Uncle Tupelo, they start playing at VFWs and stuff for fraternities in Edwardsville at the SAU. They played for Sick Pie, and they played from some of these other bands.
And Uncle Tupelo eventually became Sunvolt and Wilco, which people probably have heard of today, if not Uncle Tupelo.
And there were a few places in Edwardsville where you could play. There was the Granary and Granny's Rocker, and there was a place downtown, not far from here, I think, Spanky's, where there were some bands that played, and Stagger.
Mm-hmm.
In between the alley between Stagger and the building before it, used to have a big thing that said the Mockers. The Mockers, I'm pretty sure, were from Alton, and their big song was Corn. And when they played that, they would bring big bags of dried corn and whip it at the crowd. And I think we played with them, and I have a video of them. And their bass player went on to become assistant superintendent.
Of Edwardsville District?
Edwardsville, and now he's over in St. Louis. His specialty is fixing districts that have fallen apart.
Okay.
Bill McDonald.
Huh?
Great, great guy.
And what was the band he was in again?
The Mockers.
The Mockers.
And I don't know if you would call them... And a lot of this goes... A lot of this is, well, would they really be a punk band? I don't care. They were playing underground shows for no money in front of the same crowds that were going to go see the Ramones, and we're going to go see the Nukes, and we're going to go see Ultraman, and we're going to buy tickets to see the Clash when they came. So whether you want to call them punk or not, that's up to you.
Now, what does that mean, underground crowd? What does that mean in Madison County?
I mean, it was most of it was at VFWs and American Legions and Corner Tavern. lots of VFWs. VFWs in Collinsville, there were VFWs in Belleville. There were a couple places in Alton that I don't know very well. I know there's some places. There was a community center. There was another band called the Avon Ladies. They opened up for the Dead Kennedys, and I don't know them either. I know a little bit about them, but don't know. So there was this sporadic thing, but I think at the same time that that it explodes in Madison County or starts to surge in Madison County is this sort of second wave in St. Louis. There's an earlier wave in St. Louis that really starts in 76, and there's a little bit of a lull, I think, at some point. And I think in 84, 85, 86, there's sort of an upswing again. And so that's kind of where we came in.
And what's the fan base for underground music? You said that you often had a lot of people repeat come to shows, and that you sort of got a scene where you'd know people. And so who were those people? How did they fit? Was there a sort of conscious scene on their part?
I don't know. When we were in high school, we would have, you know, there was a small group of us in high school that not only listened to music, because there were people that listened to the music but didn't sort of outwardly show everybody that they were, you know, they wanted to be set aside. So, but we kind of did. There was a small group of us, which I came to late. I came to later. I would never claim to be, you know, the first guy at Granite that you know, bought a, I don't know, you know, came to school in a Motorhead shirt or something. I wasn't, because I was wearing bell bottoms and listening to a lot of Bob Seger. And I had to be sort of shown the door, in my, people that were my age, people like Bob and Liz Weckback, my friends Jay Huber, John Don Joyen, Jonna Williams, and Jim Brown. I mean, those people, Steve Kuzmerzik, those people had an interest in that music beforehand. And there was I think a lot of it is, you know, there's always somebody feeding you things. And Granite, there was a place called, it was a Co-op Records, and there was a place called The Record Company. And one of the guys that worked there was named Gavin Grace. And I think Gavin fed people music. And Bob worked at the record store, so I think Bob heard a lot of things and would feed it to people. And Gavin had played in like prog bands and I guess classic rock bands. I'm not even sure. In the 70s, he was older than us, but he had done a lot of this stuff, and he'd played like experimental and fusion jazz and stuff. And he was and I think in some ways it wasn't just music. It was sort of his attitude too. One of the things that Gavin would do to annoy people is he would pick two or three records out of the used bin and mark them up to 99.99, like a Partridge Family album. And people would come up to the thing and say, you know, this has got to be wrong, right? They didn't even want to buy it. They just were so upset that it was that soon. No, that's really worth a lot of money. You should put that back before you heard it. And it was great. He was kind of that. And he was, you know, by far, he was not part of the punk scene. But Gavin was just sort of amazing in his own right. He was an artist and a visual artist. And I think he was the first guy I ever talked to about Glass. Paul Glass? No.
Philip Glass?
Philip Glass. I don't, Philip wasn't sounding right. It's the first person I ever talked about Philip Glass.
Yeah. The minimalist composer.
Yeah. He was the first person that I ever heard talk about the Butthole Surfers. He was the first person that I talked to about Sonic Youth.
Now, is this about the same time you were in Beer Frog's soon-to-be Snake Ranch, or is this earlier?
I mean, I knew about Gavin earlier, but he was around for all of this stuff. But I think he's the one that fed, I think, any scene in some way in Granite is due to Gavin.
Okay.
Now, who was feeding people stuff? And there was a record company at Cottonwood Mall here in Edwardsville. But I don't think it was there that early, because I worked there for a while.
Was that Slackers?
No, there actually used to be a mall there.
Right.
And it was inside the mall.
Uh-huh.
But I worked there, Jim Utz worked there, but that was 87. So before that, you know, the person that I know of that was feeding this stuff was Gavin. Mm-hmm. whatever there was, and I'm sure there was somebody exactly like Gavin in Alton, mm-hmm. and there was somebody exactly like him in Belleville, mm-hmm. and there was somebody like him in Edwardsville. I just don't know who they are.
Right.
But Gavin was feeding us, not me as much, because I didn't know him as well as other people. Again, I came in on the tail end of a lot of things, but I was able to benefit from the things that Gavin was giving out.
Good.
And he seemed to know everything.
Yeah.
He seemed to have a knowledge of all this stuff, and he seemed to know what to direct people to.
Do you think that that's something that still exists today in the same way? Or, you know, you work with young people now, and so do you see music being discovered in a similar fashion, or is it largely now searching in algorithms?
I don't know if, I mean, the searching, I don't think is at a record store. I don't think they'll go to a record store and talk to somebody behind the desk. I don't think that's, for some people, I'm sure it is. For most of them, I think it's a matter of sitting down at the computer and looking on YouTube or GarageBand or whatever the other stuff is, or whatever. But I don't think it happens anymore. And I think it's something, the phrase I always have in my head is, music isn't an imperative anymore. It's not music, even though people like music and love music, and I don't doubt that they love it anymore, but there was a point where, at least for me, there was a point where what I listened to said way more about who I was than what music I liked.
Good. So back to the late 80s, early 90s, and, you know, when you were just starting to play in bands, and music was an imperative for you, and you felt like it was for a lot of people, too. It said something about who they were. In this region, what were the kinds of listeners, right? What was the different sort of genres that people were listening to? Maybe bands that were maybe up the feeding chain a little more or down the feeding chain. You described yourself as kind of in an underground playing at VFW. So how did you fit in the ecosystem of music listeners around you?
The nice thing was when I discovered the music and discovered the crowd, there was no, I didn't feel like there was a hierarchy to it. One of the things that was great was you were accepted almost immediately. And if you didn't know something, nobody gave you grief about it. They just said, oh, you should listen to that too. Because everybody had a different thing. And everybody had the band that they wanted to rave about. And everybody had a band that they kind of thought of as, oh, this is the thing I can tell other people. And then there was stuff that everybody listened to. I mean, everybody had, if you talk about like tapes, everybody had. The Black Flag first 5 years or whatever it is with the pre-Henry Rollins stuff. Everybody had that. Everybody had the Repo Man soundtrack. That was just like, I mean, you had to have that.
The movie Repo Man.
Yeah, yeah, because it had Jonathan Richman, Pablo Picasso on it, and it had Burning Sensations on it, and it had, I mean, it was just, you know, it was one of the things you had to have. And then everybody rented that movie all the time. So there was that stuff. But there wasn't kind of a hierarchy. When you slipped in, you slipped in, and there was not. Now, the difference, I will say there's a difference between what I always perceived as the Illinois scene and the Missouri scene.
Yeah, tell me about that.
The Illinois scene was very much more rooted in classic rock and in metal. Not that that's what it sounded like, but if you were to ask, this has just been my experience. If you were to ask, you know, at that time, if you were to walk up to somebody in a hardcore band in St. Louis and say, "What is your favorite Rush album?" They would be absolutely offended that you asked it. If you walked up to one of us and said, "What was your favorite Rush album?" Oh, I mean, my favorite. I like 2112, but I think Wish You Were Here is a part of it. Not Wish You Were Here, but Permanent Waves. That's my favorite.
Permanent Waves.
I like Permanent Waves better, but I know people who like, you know, the second or third album better. And we covered a Rush song forever, and no one ever knew what it was. But I think growing up over here, you don't have... It seemed like people in St. Louis had quicker access to record stores, and more things were going on. So people over here had a longer gestation period with classic rock. So, you know, if you, like, you go to anybody in, if you'd ask anybody in Snake Ranch or in Beer Frogs, if it was 1987, you walked over to them and said, you know, what's the name of that hit off the Angel album? They'd say, oh, The Tower. You know, what's your favorite Nazareth song? They would have some, oh, This Flight's Night. You know, Hair of the Dog. What are you talking about? If you went and asked other people, even if they knew, some people probably wouldn't even have said, because it's, you know, there was a little bit of posturing going on, and then posturing everywhere. But it seemed like those of us on this side of the river, and this doesn't go for everybody in Missouri, because Rob Wagner, who played bass for us, played in Ultraman and played in, Rob can play the bass lines for all of the Rush albums. He grew up in St. Louis. He was, you know, early, I mean, Rob's one-man punk rock explosion. But in general, it seems like there was kind of that classic rock stuff. And for us, you know, I never denied how much I like Bob Seger. You know, I never, you know, and
what do you say accounts for that? Is it just down to a rural area with smaller cities and a more urban environment in St. Louis? Or does it have something to do with something particular about the Illinois side of the river?
I think we just had less access. I think we just had less. When I worked at record company, this would have been 86, 87, we were still selling like 4 copies of the Roger Hodgson solo tape a week.
Huh.
Okay. No one should be buying Roger Hodgson's solo album, or Supertramp albums for that matter. But we were selling like 4 copies of his solo album with Sleeping with the Enemy on it a week. So, you know, it's...
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was just you had less access.
Right.
Now, my cousin, my first... I'm sure I heard the Sex Pistols at some... I'm sure I heard that name on TV or on the news or whatever. But I didn't know what it was. It was just a name that ran around my head. In 83, when we were going to Bob Seger, we stopped at the truck stop on 203, ready to get on the highway where the racetrack is now. And I went with my brother and a bunch of other guys that were big KC guys and everything. And we were at the rest of, I don't know why we stopped at the truck stop, but they were giving my cousin Richard absolute hell because he had bought the Sex Pistols album. And he liked it. But Rich was also a big classic rock guy, but he also listened to some of the other stuff, and they gave him no end of grief over it. And that was the first time I had connected that it was a band.
Yeah.
And I think within a year of that, I had the tape, not thanks to Rich, but because of people I knew, and it sort of, all of a sudden, it all kind of crystallized for me.
And what year would have that been?
It would have been... beginning of 83, end of 84.
Okay.
They combined. The big thing was, at the end of my sophomore year, there were two high schools in Grand. South, which is the high school now, and North, which is SWIC. And at the end of my sophomore year, they combined them. And the guys I knew from playing D&D who went to South, all of a sudden we were there together all the time. And, My bad hair and giant leather belt and bell bottoms were not going to happen. So there was a noticeable push to try and sort of change things, and they kept saying, "Well, don't you like the Clash? Don't you like the Clash?" And I still to this day absolutely cannot stand Combat Rock. Just think it is a terrible tape. But then one day, my friend Jay, we were riding in his car, and he threw in London Calling. I was like, oh my God, that's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of started to change things. In fact, we drove to record company one night and said, I'm going to buy my first tape. And I had a choice. We were closing. They said, you've got to grab something really quick. So there were two things sitting there, and they said, grab one. So one was Iggy Pop the Idiot, and the other was... Ramon's Subterranean Jungle. And I grabbed Subterranean Jungle, which in hindsight I think was the best thing to grab, because I like sing-songy and I like big choruses. But that was kind of where it all kind of started. And then I bought, you know, Straight Leg Jeans and got my hair cut.
But still,
those guys, even though they were into this other stuff, especially Jay. Jay was a big, big Willie Nelson fan, big, big Grateful Dead fan.
Yeah,
really liked. Really into KC Classics. He was really into the band called The Blend that had a hit with The Warrior and stuff.
So it sounds like there was a lot of actually diversity in listening over here, and that there was a lot of cross-fertilization. There weren't sort of like musical tribes where people were just dedicated to punk rock or just dedicated to metal.
The people who listen to like different kinds of music, they listen to lots of things. If you were to talk to the normal person walking down the hall at the high school, that wasn't the case.
Okay.
They would not have been willing. That your typical, what's a good example? My senior year was when Born in the USA came out.
Yeah.
Your typical Springsteen fan was not going to give the Dead Kennedys a shot.
So I want to go back to something, because you mentioned you got your hair cut and got some straight leg jeans. But I saw on YouTube a closed circuit cable broadcast of Snake Ranch, and you were had what looked like shoulder length hair and a kilt.
Yeah, that was 3 years later.
So tell me about the from Beer Frogs to 3 years later, you're on cable television with Snake Ranch. Tell me about those 3 years.
Well, Jim asked me. Jim mistakenly said he wanted to be in a band. And I got too excited about it. So we tried to played our first show in 87. The best thing that happened was we knew Club Zero. Because Club Zero had already played Mississippi Nights. They had already opened, they were opening for the Descendants, and they were, to me, with the exception of Max Lode, who was much earlier, Club Zero is the first East Side band to really make an impact. So they were playing Turner's, they were playing Mississippi Nights, they played the Descendants, they opened for Dead Milkmen, the list of people they opened for is just huge. And they were around, and they were also playing with all the bands in St. Louis. So we knew them, and they told us some things, and then we really just kind of played corner. Until summer, and I don't remember why, we made a trip over to Bernard's Pub on Lafayette in St. Louis and gave our tape to John Green, and John said, well, come over and play, and John started booking us a lot. So John must have liked us, because all of a sudden we were playing a lot. And then we got a show on the Landing. We played at Kennedy's, although when we first played at Kennedy's, they were only allowing one band a night. You had to play for 3 hours.
Oh, wow.
So we had to learn a bunch of stuff. Play was terrible. And then about 6 months later, we're like, oh, why don't we have four bands play and more people come? We started playing Bernard's. And at Bernard's, we started getting shows. We played with Henry Rollins. We played with HR from Bad Brains. We opened for Social Distortion. And
those are some big names.
So it was great. But this is all pre-92. This is all pre-Nirvana, before they started bringing bands with them, before they figured out how to make money on it. Because these people were showing up, and they were sleeping in people's houses and getting up the next morning and going.
Even Social Distortion.
Yeah, it was their first tour after he got out of prison. So it was prison. They had Mommy's Little Monster 1945 and all that stuff out, but Prison Bound was a new album. It was the first one where it kind of sounded like it does now, and or at least the first to my knowledge. But he they played, and it seems like every other song was a Stones cover. It was great. It was one of my favorite shows. Almost nobody showed up, but it was just such an amazing show.
And you opened for them.
We did. We played, and there's a couple.
And
of
where
pictures.
Were you playing? Was that
Bernard's?
In Bernard's.
That was Bernard's when it was still on Lafayette.
Okay.
And
Henry Rollins played there too.
You know, that, yeah, we opened up for Rollins there, and you know, and then there were shows. We never played there, but there were shows at there was a roller skating rink on Del Mar called Sports Palace. And we didn't play there. We were too late for that. Turner's, which was Turner's, had been like Turner's Athletic Club on Salisbury in North St. Louis. I saw Black Flag there, but everybody played there. We were too late for that. But there were lots of people playing there. Club Zero played there a whole bunch. Really everybody. There's just tons of flyers from there.
And so how often in those years before 92, and we'll get to 92 because that sounds like an important year, how often were you playing out with Snake Ranch?
Early on it was a little sporadic, but it ended up being at least every couple of weeks. And then one of the great things that happened, because we were playing, there was a place on the landing called First Rock, and we played there a lot. And then Bernard's closed and opened, and it was in the same building as First Rock. We played one show with the Frosty Factory, with Club Zero, who was Judge Nothing. We started playing Kennedy's more because they were having multiple bands. But one of the best things that happened, and we would play BFWs and stuff in Illinois, in O'Fallon, a place called, and I don't know which name came first, if it was Indoor Sports or the Tornado Shelter. This guy had like an under 21 place where kids could come play like foosball, mm-hmm. and he built a stage.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, we had an under 21 place, and he would book us every week.
Huh.
And we would play with tons of people. We would play with hardcore bands, and we would play with metal bands. Nuclear Winter, and we played with Ultraman there, and we played with Whoppers there, and we played with, and then there was all these bands from Belleville. There was Three Monster, and there was Dementia 13, and Disco Zombies, who eventually combined and became Fragile Porcelain Mice, and it was just like, we could play like every weekend there, and there was a huge crowd that showed up, and it was a blast, and it wasn't, we didn't make a lot of money, but I mean, we got to play every weekend, and we played, you know, we maybe did one cover. It was all originals, and they came and they knew the songs, and they played foosball and hung out, and it was great. So we played a lot, and then eventually the guy that ran Bernard's opened up Club 367, which was in the old Animal House building. And when it first opened up, they were booking some real cool stuff. We opened for Jesus Lizard there, and we opened for All there.
And All was Descendants, right. Became All after, yeah. Milo left, right?
Yeah. And it was, they were great. It was, and those were our two last shows. And we thought, oh, this is great, because it's a big place, huge stage, lots of seating, lots of parking. This will be great. We have a place that isn't Mississippi Nights, that isn't looking to, they're not booking Roy Buchanan.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to do this, and look, this is going to be great. And I don't know what caused it. I don't know why it went this direction, but it very quickly went from booking a lot of different stuff to booking metal, and it became almost a strictly metal place, and not like Slayer or something. A lot of, you know, metal that I wouldn't have gone to. And I went back a year later, and the band was Rabbit with a Habit, and the opening act was a guy who billed himself as the heavy metal magician. And there were foosball tables and pinball, and it was just like, all right.
But there was
a huge scene there. There are people who look back on that club as like the apex of their young adult.
And what town was this in? What town the club in?
North St. Louis.
North St. Louis.
Same place. It was the same building as Animal House.
Okay. All right.
Animal House had closed, and I think, I don't know what there was in between. It may have been like a blues bar there in between. And then Club 367 opened up, and it was great for a while. We thought this is going to be, but then we broke up.
Yeah. So where's the cable access come in there? What was that show? Because it looked like it was on quite a bit, and mm-hmm. you were sort of the featured band that episode.
We did it twice. Every week there was a local band. The very first episode was Uncle Tupelo, and they recorded it in Jay's bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
The show was Critical Mass. The lady's
That's right.
name is Dee Dee Schofield, who's from Collinsville.
Okay.
And she went to KDH or Double Helix and said, I want to do this. And so labels sent her videos. So she would, you know, run videos, and she was like a VJ. She talked about what was coming, and she talked about the calendar and what was coming out and what releases were coming out. And then she would interview the local band, and there would be like two segments where they played. And that was in between the videos. And it was amazing. I mean, there was no reason we should have been on that show, because we were schmucks. And she put us on. She put us on it actually twice. We did one in the studio, and then we did a benefit for her. And we played at Kennedy's, and it was us. And It was us and Sinister Danes and The Urge, both of whom went on to get signed to major labels and like do big tours, and us. And the Kennedy stage was about the size of four of these tables. There was nothing there, and there were the four of us plus three go-go girls and a violin player hanging off the stage. But it was great because at that point we were drawing a decent size crowd, and Sinister Danes and The Urge were drawing a massive crowd, and there were just hundreds of people. And that one's on there as well. I have pigtails in that one. And then there's some interviews from it and stuff, and she interviewed people. And it was great. I mean, she really, I think, is an unsung hero of the entire scene. And she also played videos. It was kind of like 120 minutes. But she played, you know, great, great stuff. And, you know, she was one of the people that introduced the new Dunkin' Imperials to St. Louis, you know, because she was a big, and she played a lot of this stuff. She was a big Replacements fan, and so you could see all that stuff on there. So she did a lot of it. It was great. She was, like I said, you know, the people that are in bands, we have to do reunions. And people, Dee Dee doesn't get near the recognition she should, because it was great. And there were a couple of others. There was one called Velocity. It was a little bit later. It was mid-90s. And then there was apparently somebody at SIU in the TV department that did some stuff in the early 80s. But no one seems to know much about it. Max Lode, I think, did one. But there doesn't seem to be a lot of information about it.
So how did the shop Hullabaloo fit or influence any kind of scene that you were in?
Donna Knott, who was one of the people that started it. Donna had, she was tending bar in St. Louis in the 70s, and she was the first person to bring in touring punk rock acts. She booked Eddie and the Hot Rods. She booked 999 and the Dickies. She brought in Steel Pulse to stages, which was right there by the highway on 203. And so she was booking that stuff, and she was also doing these punk rock record spins at clubs in St. Louis. And then there was a guy, and so she was doing that, but she was also, she's always been, I think, a finished clothes person. So they bought, she was, I don't remember if she worked there. She just knew a place called Edgar DeSoto. And Edgar DeSoto sold vintage clothing. And she eventually, I think, bought it out or bought the stock or whatever. And she opened up a small place called Hullabaloo with a guy named Dana Hunchy. And Donna knew everybody. Donna to this day knows everybody. Donna knows everyone walking. So whatever Donna did, people followed, and Hullabaloo would have some shows and stuff. But everybody would come in because they knew they could pick up clothes. And she also, I think, and I'll get yelled at if I'm wrong, I believe she was involved in the punk rock fashion show in like 81 or something like that. So she's just been there the whole time. So people naturally came to the store to buy stuff. And as it grew, you know, it was the only place in St. Louis that you could buy an MC5 shirt or a Dead Kennedy shirt. You know, you could go in and you could buy Doc Martens, or you could buy Manic Panic stuff for your hair, or you could buy Lip Service, which was like, do you remember Lip Service?
Uh-uh.
It was almost like hair metal goth clothes from L.A. You know, it's... but you could come in and buy that, and you could also come in and buy used clothes. You could go in and, you know, flannel shirt to tie around your waist so you could look like the kid on the Circle Jerks album, you could go buy it there. They had t-shirts, they had boots, and they had all this other stuff. And then you could get posters. They had posters there. So everybody just kind of followed Donna. So that was one of the things that, you know, we discovered. And I don't remember who told me about it originally. Somebody said, you should go over to Hullabaloo. And I remember the first time I went over, I was just stunned. They had James Brown shirts. I bought a James Brown shirt. I was with my girlfriend. And I said, what should I buy, the Addams Family or the James Brown shirt? And she goes, well, you know you're going to have more fun in the James Brown shirt. Mm-hmm. And I bought an African Bambaataa and the Soul Sonic Force shirt. Where are you going to get an African Bambaataa shirt? And I wish I had it. I traded it to Anthony Kiedis from Red Hot Chili Peppers at the show. He was like, I need that. He said, we're friends with his son. And I traded him for a shirt and like a bunch of stickers. And my mom saw the shirt and threw it away.
Was this at a Red Hot Chili Peppers show?
It was them. I'm pretty sure it was the Masters of Funk tour. It was them, Fishbone, and Thelonious Monster.
Okay.
So, you know, we bought this stuff there. And then we did Critical Mass with Dee Dee. And it turned out that Dee Dee worked at Hullabaloo. And I was complaining. I was working at a record store downtown in St. Louis. But it was a corporate thing. It was Camelot Records, and they were making me cut my hair all the time. And she said, and at that point, I was, when my hair was long in high school, it was nicely feathered. By the time I got to this point, I was growing it out. You know, all these hardcore bands had long hair, so I was growing my hair out. And I liked it. And I will admit to having a thing for Bono at that point, so I was growing my hair. I want to try and be honest about my own stupidity.
Yeah, sure.
But I said, I'm sick of cutting it. And so, well, I think I can get you a job. So I went and saw Donna and talked to him. And they said, why do you want? I said, I want to do something else. I want to stop cutting my hair. And she hired me. And I worked there. Jim Saltsider, who was in a ton of early bands, worked there. Ray Kirsch, who was in Lydia's Trumpet, worked there. And there were just all these guys there that... And the cool thing was, even the guys that didn't play in bands that were there, they knew everybody. For me, it was an entry into a generation I had missed. Because once I knew Donna, all these other people started showing up. And because I worked at Hullabaloo, I knew Donna. And all of a sudden, these guys, Don Hollenbeck, and you know, all these guys, all of a sudden were friends. They were, you know, I would see them out. And it was like, oh... And I would see, so it was a huge, for me, it was an entryway into all of this, because it gave me, and I know Donna may not appreciate that I put it like this, or other people might, but it gave me a little bit of, I don't know, cachet or whatever, to be able to worm my way into this older crowd, which 30 years later has become a huge deal, because I, even though I'm now 30 years older, those guys are the ones, and ladies, are the ones who were really, really a big deal in the 70s and 80s. And I have this connection with them, which is completely through, for the most part, through Hullabaloo. Through Donna. Through Donna, I know these people. Through Donna, I know this story. Through Donna, I can connect this band. And there's lots of other people, too. But, you know, it was hopping from... Critical Mass to Hullabaloo was a huge deal because it gave me, and in fact, at some point we bought a bunch of real obnoxious shorts, deadstock shorts, and she didn't know what they were going to look like, so she had me try them on one day at the warehouse, and so she called them Snake Ranch shorts, and that's what they were which I never owned a pair, but that was what they called them in the catalog.
Yeah.
So. That was a huge thing, and everybody went to Hullabaloo to shop.
Now, you implied 1992 was kind of a watershed year, and I don't know if that was off the cuff or if you had that already on your mind.
No, but it's, I mean, once Nevermind hits, everything changes. I mean, it's, and not all, and I don't want to sound like old man screams at cloud. Yeah. There were things that were good that changed. A lot of people I know actually made some money finally. And for that matter, Henry Rollins finally, you know, had enough to buy a house. Because I'm sure he wasn't buying a big house before. But people started making, but it also meant that a lot of bands, at that point, I guess this is the trade-off. There were bands in St. Louis, local bands, that could sell out Mississippi Nights. Fragile could, Ultraman could, you know, Sinister Danes, The Urge could, you know, these bands could sell out Mississippi Nights. But it also meant that bands weren't getting the opening slots that they had been two or three years before, because when most bands went on tour, their record labels sent them with another band. You know, that stuff was predetermined. It didn't happen always, but it was part of it. And the moment that I knew it was, the moment I knew it was different, we were at Mississippi Nights, went and saw John Spencer Blues Explosion. And that was probably later than 92, but I don't think much. And we had broken up by then. and I stopped going to shows quite a bit. We went and saw them because I like John Spencer. And Demolition Doll Rods opened up, were really great. But before the show, there was a big guy in a football jersey with a brand new mohawk punching girls in the crowd. Like, oh, I'm slamming, I'm doing this. So I went, and that was just never the case. And I went over to one of the guys, one of the B&D security guys, and I said, look, there's a guy here who's going to start a fight as soon as it starts. And the B&D security guys were not the nicest people in the world. And he looked at me, he tried to blow me off, and I said, look, you stand on your chair. If you can't pick him out, I'll go home and not ask for a refund. So he stood on his chair, and he said, son of a bitch. And he walked over and threw the guy out because it was, but those people weren't at shows. They were always, people would show up occasionally, but it was all of a sudden, It drew in a lot of people who wouldn't have found it before, who were all then passionate about the line. But it also drew in people who would have normally been fighting at a Kiss concert. The crowd got much bigger, and it wasn't as enjoyable. But I wouldn't go so far as to say it was an all bad thing, because there are people who benefited from it a lot, and a lot of people who discovered it who are still. It changed their lives. So it's not up to me to say it was a good thing or a bad thing. But originally, the St. Louis scene, they referred, Bob Trammell, I think, but I could be wrong, called them the Fun 100, because Magazine played at the basement of the Keel, I think.
Wow.
And 100 people showed up. And that was like 77 or 78.
Yeah.
So they called themselves the Fun, or they were referred to as the Fun 100. And even when I started, it was a relatively small crowd, and you knew people, and the people that were there, and maybe shared a sense of community because there wasn't a lot of people that were into it, but that changed things greatly. And more people came in, and that's never a bad thing, but it changed the makeup of some of it, too.
Right. Would you say it ceased to be as much of a scene?
I wouldn't say that. I think it just changed the nature of the scene. The scene grew, and if a small town becomes a city, if you take, for instance, the impression that people always have of Austin as this great place where there's underground bands and you can go hang out and be bohemian, that hasn't existed in 25 years. It's a corporate town where you're going to pay serious money. It doesn't mean that it's all bad,
yeah.
But the people who went there for that reason,
so changes.
Yeah, so I mean, the scene didn't change because the scene persists. The scene is there today, but the nature of it changes,
yeah.
And it changes repeatedly, and it has changed again.
Good.
So
yeah, well, I got to run.
Okay,
so I appreciate it, Greg. This has been Jason, Stacy, and Greg Kessler talking about music in the late '80s and '90s in Madison County and St. Louis for Madison Historical. Signing off.